This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have good news to pass along today from the South Shore Line on the process that is underway for some major rehabilitation projects, two of them in particular that we have talked about in the past, about the Westlake Corridor as well as the double tracking segment of the project, which in turn will expand the South Shore Line through Northwest Indiana. With us to talk about it this morning, we have Mike Noland, who is the president of the South Shore Line. And Mike, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Chris, happy to be here as always.
Well, before we get into more details here about the project, I guess really it's the best information that's come out latest here from a recent board meeting is that it's pretty good news that it's going to cost everybody a little less money than first thought to get some of the major work done. Fill us in on that first, please.
Well, when we had a opening of our proposals, Chris, in January for the Westlake construction project, the pricing came in higher than we were hoping. It came in about $664 million for the design-build contract on Westlake. So the NICTI team, along with our project partners helping us, IFA and RDA, we set out with the negotiation with the firm that was the deemed low best value contractor, a team from called FH Passion from Chicago. They're partnering with Regner Benson. And between the NICTI team and the FH Passion team, we were able to reduce the pricing on the contract by $110 million. So that was a significant achievement, I think, by everyone who put a lot into making sure that we got good pricing, but also we're still going to be able to deliver the essential elements of the Westlake project. And the NICTI board yesterday, as you said, gave me the authority to go ahead and execute the contract as soon as we get that federal grant, which we're expecting here in the next couple months.
Now, that should come, as you say, pretty soon, and that'll cover a major part of the expense, won't it?
Yeah. We actually, about a month ago, we got a tweet from the President of the United States, and however you want to take that, but this tweet was a positive tweet, in which it was announced that we were receiving an advanced $100 million from the federal government towards the Westlake project. That was the really the ultimate sign that you could get that you're going to get a grant from the federal government. We're anticipating about $350 million towards the funding of the Westlake project. That's not the exact amount, I don't have it in front of me.
Right.
But basically, the federal government's paying 60%. And the state of Indiana through the various sources. So we're getting money from the General Assembly. We got initial $6 million a year for 30 years in 2015. The governor came through with the General Assembly in 2019 with an additional up to $205 million for both projects. And then we're getting funded here by Lake County and the Northwest Indiana RDA through a number of individual municipalities, cities, the county itself, the RDA. There's a lot of folks who are. It goes into that overall funding pot, and you know this is a project that's going to be transformational. So to have a lot of folks putting in, a lot of different entities putting in, that shows the overall support that the Westlake project has.
Now we'll get into more detail here a little bit about the two projects that we just mentioned here at the outset of the conversation in a moment. But we should ask the question: when's construction going to start? When are people likely to start seeing some activity in the areas that we've been talking about for seemingly a long time?
Sure, we're hoping, and we're working shoulder to shoulder with the FTA to get this grant agreement ready to go and executed. And the moment we have that grant agreement, which we're targeting for the end of September, we're going to immediately sign the construction contract and give them a notice to proceed. Frankly, they're already starting some engineering design work at risk right now because they're that confident of the fact that we're going to get the overall funding for the project. That $100 million tweet really helped because they're already starting some advance work. But from a construction side, we'll give the NTP probably on or around September 30th.
Now, the Westlake Corridor project is probably the most expansive of the two, I would imagine, because we're talking about 8 miles of rail line. They're going to run from Dyer to Hammond, and they make up the connections to the existing line that runs through the communities, at least through Hammond, I'm sure. And that's going to mean a lot more work to go in that particular area. Is that why this project is going to get an earlier start than the double tracking, just expanding
the
track?
Actually, the planning process for the Westlake project started a little ahead of double track, so mm-hmm. they're really very close in time. But the Westlake design environmental process started a whole year or year and a half ahead of the double track design and engineering or environmental.
Yeah.
So they're slightly ahead, but you're right. It is more complex, and there's a lot of work up in Hammond because we're going to be up in the air on elevated structure for a long way, over a mile of elevated structure on this project. That makes it much more complex. We're going over the river. We're going over the Norfolk Southern, the Illinois Harbor Belt, or Indian Harbor Belt. We're going over the CSX. So there's a lot of aerial over Holman Avenue, a lot of aerial construction that makes this more complicated than the double track project.
Yeah, because that's mostly on the ground, isn't it? And a lot of it is trying to make some changes to what is existing on the ground, especially in Michigan City and Miller, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the two key areas where we're having major change. In Michigan City, we're getting off of our middle of the street running on 10th Street, and we're acquiring our own right-of-way on the south side of 10th Street. And then when we travel on Michigan or on 11th Street, for about a mile and a quarter, we're gonna separate the trains from auto and bike traffic that's on 11th Street. So we're gonna have our own dedicated right of way on 11th Street, and then we'll also close a number of crossings, and the remaining crossings will all have gates, lights, and bells instead of the current environment today, which is basically just a crossbuck or a stop sign.
Yes.
So it's a tremendous safety in enhancement there in Michigan City. In Miller, we're going to be working with NDOT, who's about to start a complementary project where they're going to move US 12 as it is coming into the Miller area of Gary. They're going to divert 12 east of Lake Street over to US 20, and as you know, 12 and 20 come together about a 3/4 mile to the west anyway. So they're going to move that connection 3/4 mile to the east, merge those two roads together, and then they're going to abandon US 12 in that section. And we're then going to take our rail tracks and we're going to shift them to the south and basically put them on what was the old US 12 right-of-way. And that allows us to put two high-level platforms at the Miller Station there in Gary. So that's a major change there for that community, and the tremendous support from the Miller Aetna community for this enhancement.
We're talking with Mike Noland. He's the president of the South Shore Line about all of the expansion that is going to be coming up. You'll actually start seeing construction hopefully before the end of the year, but certainly the planning, which has been underway for years, it seems, in not only the Westlake Corridor project, but also with the double tracking work that's running between Gary and through Michigan City. One of the things I know we keep an eye on as well, too, is how the impact is going to be for communities, for example, like Hammond. I know there's a lot of talk about the changing of the tracks and the like. The impact it's going to have not only on the neighborhoods where the tracks go through now and will continue to go through, but also economic development in the region. And that's where I know this concept that is talked about before about transit-oriented development comes into play. Explain a little bit more about that, if you will, and what kind of impact that the projects, both of them, I suppose, but in particular, the Westlake Corridor will have.
This is really an economic development project, not necessarily a rail project. The rail project is the driver mm-hmm. to open up the opportunity or unlock the opportunity for economic development, getting people, reducing travel time and increasing frequencies back and forth to Chicago, which is a major business community in the world, really opens up economic opportunities that we've never really developed and tried to develop here in the region. The RDA is leading that charge. They are developing transit development districts in and around every one of the rail stations, whether it's Westlake or Double Track, so that they can leverage the improvement and entice development, whether it's retail, residential, a mixture of both, office type environment, and there's really major excitement about the area in Hammond there, where the Westlake trains and the South Shore trains come together in what we call our gateway station. You can transfer back and forth between Westlake and South Shore, so therefore you can go either any direction you want. You can come from Dyer, jump on the train there at the end of the line, get transfer off at the Hammond station, and go on out to South Bend. Or someone from South Bend can come in, go to the city, or they can jump off at Gateway and go to Munster Dyer. Mm-hmm. There's great flexibility that project or this station allows. And there's tremendous excitement in and around the station for development opportunity.
I know it's been particularly rough with the pandemic that is still underway here in Northwest Indiana and everywhere. But what kind of impact are we seeing? Any improvement, I guess, over time now on the South Shore line? It's been really rough, I know, for travel through the region because of the illness.
So, without question, we've been reporting our ridership that has gone down to really. During the stay-at-home order, we were down to about 5% of normal. Mm-hmm. So we reduced our schedules, and we maintained longer trains just to promote social distancing. And we were primarily transporting healthcare workers, essential healthcare workers who were going into the Chicago hospitals to treat our most sick citizens. And so, that has continued. We're still transporting those individuals, but we're now up to about 15% to 20% of our normal ridership on a daily basis. That's really not going to change dramatically until Chicago begins to reopen and people feel more comfortable. But in the interim, Chris, we've taken substantial steps on the South Shore line to make sure that when our riders are ready to come back, when they feel comfortable to travel back and forth to Chicago or from Chicago here to the region, they'll know that the system they're riding is different than it was before. We have really taken steps to increase the sanitization on the trains, the cleanliness of the trains. We've hired 10 more employees to help us with those efforts. We've purchased electrostatic devices and using the top sprays that will kill the virus and continue to kill it. We've increased the frequency of our cleaning. We've purchased fogging machines that will get on every surface of the rail car. So that we know we can kill the viruses or other bacteria that's on the train. We purchased high-powered steam cleaners. These cars have never been cleaner since the day they came off the factory line, and we're going to continue to do that and explore technologies like UV lighting that will kill viruses. So, we're a part of the entire commuter railroad industry across the country. We're monitoring and sharing our best practices on our trains. You're required to wear a mask. If for some reason you are opposed to wearing a mask, we've provided you with a mask optional car. But I will tell you, an overwhelming majority of our riders are riding the cars where masks are required. Our employees are wearing masks. We want to do everything we can. We're following the governor and his advice to mask up Hoosiers. That's our motto as well. And we're going to continue to do that so that we can get our, we can do our part to reduce the impacts of this pandemic.
Well, I know you mentioned it briefly here, but I'm glad to know that you're getting at least some attention from other commuter lines around the country, I'm sure, and to see how things work on the South Shore line and try to see if those practices work from them.
They're very curious on our mask optional car because that really is a concern. A lot of our fellow commuter lines have a mask-required policy, but enforcement is difficult, and the main thing you're getting complaints on around the country is, you're telling me that it's safe to ride the train, yet I get on the car and there's someone there not wearing a mask. They're coughing, they're sneezing, they're doing whatever, and that defeats the purpose. So our mask optional approach is something that their fellow commuter carriers around the country are watching to see if it's successful. So far, we've had no issues with anyone who says, I refuse to move. In that instance, we then will have to call for assistance from our police force. Mm-hmm. But we haven't had that. People appreciate that they're given the option. We're our conductors have extra masks if someone forgets theirs. I think right now people feel comfortable coming back to the system, and that it's going to be a gradual process, but we're ready for our riders when they're ready to come back.
Mike Noland is the president of the South Shore Line. And once again, if you will, Mike, give us the web addresses so people that want to stay up with the projects that are underway, how they can find out more.
Sure. Just Google mysouthshoreline.com, and our homepage will come up. Scroll over to the About section, and there's a drop-down screen that has information on how to ride, our fares, news, specific information on both projects. So you can click on a Westlake link or a double track link to get more detailed information. There's a whole host of information you can get on the projects on our website, www.mysouthshoreline.com.
Mike Noland, thank you very much for spending time with us today, and we appreciate it. And we're looking forward for that big groundbreaking ceremony that's going to happen sometime soon.
Me too, Chris. Me too.
Coming up on August 4th, there will be a very special, what's called a Radiothon Live, and it's a special event, a fundraiser for the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, honoring 75 years of serving the Northwest Indiana community. And with us to talk about it, we have the president and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod. And Dr. McLeod, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is a tough time for everybody, and it's especially a tough time for folks in urban communities and with the areas where the Urban League works the hardest to help out. Tell us a little more about the efforts that are going behind the fundraiser and what all the money that you're hoping to raise in this event on August 4th is all about.
August 4th is a fundraiser that we just recently put together, actually. That's based on the fact that we were to have our large luncheon. We usually have a diversity and inclusion luncheon in March, but due to COVID, like everyone else, we had to shut down. So that was our main fundraiser. So since we didn't have that, we are a nonprofit agency, 501c3, and that's really where we get our support from in order to help families in the communities in Lake Porter and LaPorte County. So since this is our 75th year, you know, I said, well, let's do something else. Let's try to get some other additional monies coming into the organization because, as you know, Chris, a lot of organizations have just had to shut their doors completely because it has impacted them, you know, based on the economic crises that we're going through due to this COVID. Mm-hmm. So we're having a radiothon that's going to be on Tuesday, August 4th, and we're asking people to give a contribution of $75, which represents 75 years. And we want you to do that by dropping a donation off here at the office, 3101 Broadway, and that's Gary, Indiana. Or you can call our office at 887-9621 and make a pledge over the phone. And, of course, we can take your credit card information and put it right in the system, or you can go online, go on our webpage, which is www.ulofnwi.org and click the donate button, and you can donate that way. But if you come on August 4th, we're going to give you back a little token of appreciation.
Oh, and what is that going to be? Maybe I should ask.
I can't tell you.
Oh, I
see. It's a surprise.
It's a surprise, of course. I should understand that.
We serve the entire community, so I'm glad to have strong collaborations and partnerships with you all. We've been around 75 years, and we've been promoting, you know, cultural diversity and economic opportunities, and we've been trying to have a transformational change in Lake Porter and LaPorte counties because those are the areas that we serve. We've touched over 5,000 children annually, like through our scholarships.
Wow.
We just offered scholarships to about 30 deserving students. That was about $40,000 that we gave out. During the pandemic, we partnered with Lake Area United Way and Legacy Foundation, and we were able to give out food gift cards to Strack and Van Til. We gave out $50 Strack and Van Til cards. The first organization that came to the table was Horizon Bank. They said, this is for you. You use these gift cards for anyone that's in need throughout Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. So those are some of the things that we were doing while everyone was sheltered in. We were in here mailing out gift cards of $50 from Strack and Van Til's to those families that was abruptly affected by, you know, shutting down, like some of the waitresses.
A lot of unfortunate situations with businesses. Restaurants in particular and other businesses that rely on a lot of contact with the public, and they couldn't be open because of not only the stay-at-home order, but just because of the businesses themselves, yeah.
Exactly. So we were in the office, my secretary, myself, and a couple of others. We were doing that. In fact, we also scheduled, just maybe about 3 weeks ago, we were able to schedule people that are considered non-filers, for instance.
Yeah.
If you make less than $12,000 and you were not required to file your taxes in 2018 or 2019, there was no way that the government could send you your stimulus check. So we came in, Legacy Foundation provided us with some funding so that we could help those people file their taxes so that they could get their stimulus check. And then we've been passing out food baskets. You know, we partnered with another agency, and we've been passing out food baskets, like 50 pounds of fresh produce and fruit, pork and some beef and chicken nuggets, a whole lot of things we've been doing. So I'm now asking the community to give back to us, you know. Give us $75 for 75 years. And if you don't have $75, just come by and give us whatever donation you have, because every little bit helps.
We're talking with Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod, who is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. We should take a moment and talk about the fact that you have been in charge of the Urban League for, will be 10 years this year.
And you believe it, 10 whole years.
Give us some ideas of how, when you came into the job, things have changed so much, aside from the pandemic, but just how the community has changed and how the response to what the Urban League in Northwest Indiana does.
When I came into the Urban League 10 years ago, back in 2010, it was very challenging because the Urban League was in a crisis situation. In fact, we have a national headquarters in New York, and when they interviewed the top three candidates, and I was one of the top three candidates, they said to us that things had not been going well for the Urban League, and it was on the verge of being closed. And I live here in Gary. This is my community. I just felt that this is an icon in the community. We cannot afford to let the Urban League of Northwest Indiana close its doors. When I came in and was appointed president CEO, the community just came out in full numbers to just help. There was some cleaning that needed to be done. There was some fixing, some painting. We had to clean house.
Yeah.
Let me just say that.
You had to quite literally clean house because of the condition that the office was in when you came into it, huh?
Correct. Had to do that. You know, I had to brush off the bylaws. I had to call board members who had not been in the building in years. You know, just a number of things. And it's like I have to give respect to the shoulders that I stand on, and it's no disrespect to my previous predecessor, but it's just like you and I. You know, you come into an organization. She was here for 30 years. 30 years she led, but what if she came in at age 40 or 50 and stayed 30 years? Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get tired. You just can't run that race as quickly at 80 as you did at 30 or 40.
Yeah.
So, yes, I had to come in and do some things, but I still stand on her legacy, especially her legacy of education. So there were a number of people that came before me that I just want to, you know, acknowledge and give respect to, because the Urban League has been around over 100 years, actually. The Urban League and the NAACP was founded over 100 years ago, and our purpose basically was to help those African Americans basically that migrated from the South to the North to obtain jobs and education and a number of other things, and we're still doing that. And here today, currently, we're still fighting for the rights of people who are discriminated against. You know, we still have that issue. You know, we have two pandemics. We have the COVID and we have the racism. And the Urban League also provides professional training to agencies so that we can talk about race relations in a safe space. So that's something else that we do. But for 75 years, the Urban League has been here. Our targeted area is Lake Porter and LaPorte County. And I would hope that the listening audience would send us a check for $75 or $25, and they can mail that check to 3101 Broadway, Gary, Indiana, 46409, or they can call our office at 219-887-9621 and make a pledge over the phone, and we'll mail you some information, or we'll just take your credit card number, mm-hmm. or just go to our website, www.ulofnwi.org, and click the donate button.
Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. And thank you for being with us to talk about not only the Urban League, your tenure so far, the 10 years now that you've been the lead in the office of the Urban League, yeah. and how important the Urban League of Northwest Indiana is to the community. Thank you for being with us. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Today, if any student was going to Gary Roosevelt, as I remember Gary Roosevelt and others, it would cost a fortune. It would be a prestigious academy that taught excellence in academics and scholarship and education and how to behave and how to live together and work together. I mean, you would have to have really been pretty affluent to have afforded to go to that school, but it was a public school. Most people remember Gary Roosevelt for his athletic prowess, winning championships and sending great athletes on out of the communities, the colleges and professionals and others. But there was also an excellence as it related to academics, as it related to extracurricular, the bands, the ROTC units, high-y clubs, everything. And everybody at Roosevelt strived for excellence. The school, the lawn, the buildings, it was clean, pristine, in fact. I guess because of the fact that we were segregated, but in our minds, there was a collective vision to show that we were on a par or superior to anyone. Often, we would get textbooks, and you'd look at the back of the textbook, and it was stamped Lew Wallace High School, which was all white. So we knew it was a hand-me-down textbook. It may have not been the latest edition. You know, after the new books came in, they went to Lew Wallace and they passed them down to us. But we had administrators and instructors who told us that the history in those books is not going to change. We want you to learn it. We want you to know it. We want you to excel at it. You can make positives out of situations. And I think we did that as an all-black school and an all-black community. We wanted to show, prove to ourselves and to the greater world that was out there that was making the decisions and having all of the influence, that we were, as I suggested earlier, on a par or superior to people that we were judged as being less than equal to. There were some great strides to be made by utilizing that as a motivating force to excel. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the fact that integration started to take place, then you can't just limit it to what was beneficial to you in high school. Then there were opportunities for jobs that you couldn't have otherwise. There were opportunities for quality of life, where you live. Maybe, you know, six to one, half a dozen of the other, or that may not be an equal balance. I don't know, but I think there are arguments to be stated on both sides. Minority students who would go to a school that was predominantly white, of course, they're going to encounter rejection, racism, those kinds of things. But maybe all of that was necessary, just like the civil rights movement, to advance our country, to get us to where now we're sitting here having an interview. Let's face it, you have to measure what the gains are and what are the overall impact. Maybe all of it was necessary to get us to where we are now, and it continues to be a point. Just look at what's going on in our debates and, you know, our national, local, state politics. We're still evolving. So I think everything that happened then was necessary for the advancements that we enjoy today.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The Indiana Water Summit has met for the last 2 years in Indianapolis and bills itself as an apolitical, inclusive forum that's developed to help come up and better look at some of the complex issues and interests that face Indiana's very diverse water supply. Well, this year, the third annual Indiana Water Summit, because of the coronavirus pandemic, is going to be held virtually. And in fact, it'll be held on August 12th and 13th. From the Athenaeum in downtown Indianapolis. And with us to talk about it, the major sponsor for the event, the White River Alliance, we have Executive Director of the White River Alliance, Jill Hoffman, with us. Jill, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks so much for having us.
Well, for
nice
folks,
to talk to you.
Well, nice to talk with you. And if you will, first explain what the White River Alliance is all about.
We're a regional watershed organization that's a nonprofit, and we are governed by a very diverse board of stakeholders that, you know, represent everybody from industry like Eli Lilly to county surveyors to researchers to our cities and towns. And the idea is just to be able to find ways to work together to protect and improve water supplies. So we do that across a 16-county area in central Indiana. But some of our work, like the Water Summit, then spans statewide because some of those conversations are of a larger policy nature.
I know that's been a major problem in recent years, to be sure, a concern about the quantity of fresh water, clean fresh water in particular. It may be more plentiful in some areas. It's not without a good supply here in northwest Indiana, but that's only because we have Lake Michigan nearby. But some other parts of the state, I really have to scrounge around and look for it, I would imagine.
Yeah, you're right. It's not spread evenly, which can create some challenges. You guys are lucky in the northern tier up there to have a lot of rich water assets, part of the Great Lakes Basin and then even the upper part of the Tippecanoe River system and all the lakes and wetlands that are up there that provide supply and replenish groundwater. So you guys are sitting pretty good in that way, but you also have a lot of users interested and, a lot of industry dependent on it, too. So we like to, remember that we work together as this one state economy, and so we have to have some conversations that help acknowledge the challenges that reach across all the regions.
What is the White River Alliance finding, because we are going through the coronavirus pandemic right now, as far as water supply is concerned, is it a little better only because we don't have the tourism, we don't have the outdoor recreation as much as what we normally would have this time of year?
Well, actually, we're finding that our rivers and our canoe liveries and those kind of things are packed, and the numbers are higher than they've ever been because nobody has kids in summer camps and nobody's taking vacations and that kind of thing. So your backyard opportunities become really even more important to your quality of life when no one's traveling. But you are right. It's important in terms of, tourism and numbers that people come here to enjoy some of those things like the dunes lakeshore that you have up there or some of our inland lakes. So it is important for that part of our life, but it's as much or even more important for, drinking water and business and industry. We're a huge state that depends on water for manufacturing as well.
I know every year during the Indiana Water Summit, you try to pick some topics that will help offer up some ideas and certainly find a way for discussion to come about on water policies, on the best water management practices across the state. What are some of the topics that are going to come up in this year's virtual third year of the Indiana Water Summit coming up next month?
Thanks for asking that because we're really excited about the agenda. So this is the first year that we're hosting the half-day regional forum beforehand, which is going to kind of showcase, how some other states are doing regional planning and how our state is looking at some of those ideas. So we have some folks from, the Indiana Finance Authority and DNR, and then some researchers that are part of a study looking at supply and demand in central Indiana. So that will be an interesting conversation about thinking regionally about cooperating among users. And then the full day summit on the 13th has a number of different topics, but we get to these topics because in past summits we've asked all of the different user groups, what the priorities and issues are in their water sector, and then what some of the best management strategies are. And then we try to bring in both some national speakers and then some local folks to help drive home what we could get done here. So this year we have some interesting sessions that are looking at how agriculture intersects with source water protection. So a conversation that includes a project out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that has some interesting things going on between their agricultural community and their city water utilities. And then we'll have some folks from Indiana in the same roles kind of talk about, could we mimic a strategy like that here, where our farming community is helping and in partnership with our drinking water utilities to protect water quality. And then we have another really interesting session where we're looking at how you manage water locally, stormwater management controls, either through, you know, innovative green infrastructure design, the way we're designing our communities, or the way we're protecting floodplains and wetlands to help manage that stormwater as an asset instead of just, you know, throwing it in a drain and then sending it down to the Gulf of Mexico full of pollution. Mm-hmm. So that's a conversation where we'll look at some national examples of best practices, but then we'll have some local public officials try to answer questions like, how could we make some of that happen here in our system and with our partnerships?
I know in the past sessions that come up, there's been some discussion here, certainly on what the legislature can do when they are in session. And although they have a lot of other issues they've had to deal with lately, I know not many sessions ago, one of our own legislators here in Northwest Indiana, State Senator Ed Charbonneau, has been quite a champion for clean water, for the supply of water to continue to grow and be better managed. What kind of lessons have everybody learned from what he has offered up, which I know ended up being a bill that was introduced and passed in the General Assembly, I think at least a couple years ago.
Yeah, I believe you're talking about Senate Bill 4, and you're right. Ed Charbonneau has been a great champion, and that's funny that you mentioned that, because he created over the last two legislative sessions two different task forces. One of them was looking at water infrastructure, so mm-hmm. our drinking and wastewater and stormwater, like hard built infrastructure, and the potential failures and aging of that infrastructure. And then there was another task force that the legislature convened on stormwater, which included both agricultural runoff and urban stormwater management. And so recommendations have come out of both of those task forces, but one of the biggest ones that moved toward implementation was to start to have drinking water and wastewater utilities have regional conversations to start to look at, you know, how can we maximize the management of that water and the investment of infrastructure by cooperating in different water management regions. So the day on the 12th, when we're talking about regional planning, we fully expect a lot of our water utilities, both waste and drinking water, to participate in that as part of what came out of Senate Bill 4, encouraging those conversations.
I know that many people come into Central Indiana usually in person, but since this is a very much a virtual event this year, if anyone's interested in participating or being at least an attendee of the third annual Indiana Water Summit, how can they do so this year?
Yeah, the best thing to do is go to indianawatersummit.org, and that will take you to our website that has the agenda and list of speakers and a registration link. And this year, because it's virtual, we're really hoping to draw people just like folks from your region, from all over the states. They don't have to make the trip necessarily. And we are planning to try to keep this really interesting with, you know, making sure we have enough long breaks for people and some live music and a lot of good interactive ways for people to provide input throughout the day. So I would say hop on, register, check it out. We want to hear as many voices helping us kind of inform the conversations around water as we can get.
Well, Jill, let's hope we have a lot of participants here from Northwest Indiana and Northern Indiana in general that will want to find out more about these topics that we've talked about today, the very important topics of making sure that Indiana has plenty of fresh water, not only for the time being, but for the future as well. The pandemic-sensitive third annual Indiana Water Summit is coming up on August 12th and the 13th. It'll be from the Athenaeum in downtown Indianapolis. And Jill Hoffman is the executive director of the White River Alliance. And Jill, thank you very much for the great information, and we hope you have great attendance for this event this year, even though it wouldn't be quite the same because everybody won't physically be together.
Right, but we think we've got a good plan to make sure everybody is engaged and hearing everybody's ideas and really sharing some strategies. So we look forward to seeing you online.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow, we begin a look at how Northwest Indiana colleges and universities are going to get ready to begin to accept students for a new academic year. We have a conversation coming up with Purdue University Northwest Provost Chris Halford. And we, of course, Greenfleet Radio with Carl Lissick with South Shore Clean Cities. And Art on the Air Spotlight is on tomorrow. That's with Larry Breckner and Esther Golan. And the topic will be about the Portage Art Show, which is coming up. I hope you can join us for tomorrow's Regionally Speaking.